And in my head, it made so much sense, even though it's so dangerous. Like, it just made perfect sense to my little 13-year-old self. So I started from there, and I noticed people would compliment me on my weight loss. People were saying, "You're looking really well." And that, I can't wrong those people for complimenting me because I didn't know, but that in my head meant you're doing the right thing.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Walt Drennan, and you're listening to Ask Me About My Type 1, the Q&A podcast all about type 1 diabetes. Hello again, type 1s and nuns. The topic of this week's conversation is a serious one, and I wanted to let everyone know up front before I got too far into my intro to avoid causing anyone any unnecessary distress or anxiety. So, this is my trigger warning because this week's conversation is about diabulimia and eating disorders. Diabulimia is hard to talk about, not just because of its clearly sensitive nature, but because of how relatively unknown it still is. 20 years ago, when I was first diagnosed with my type 1, the term didn't even exist yet, and has only recently become part of the diabetes lexicon. But of course, like most difficult to talk about things, the diabetes community needs to keep this conversation open, because we're realizing more and more just how common eating disorders like diabulimia are in our community. And to help me do this, I have on my new friends Edie and Ronan. Edie joins us as our type 1 this week, and a recently featured ambassador for the Eating Disorders Association of Northern Ireland, to talk about her experience going through what she now recognizes as diabulimia when she was a teenager in boarding school. Because again, the term didn't exist at the time she was actually going through it. Ronan, Edie's partner and our type nun this week, joins us to give his take on learning about Edie's diabulimia at the same time she did, and the perspective it gave him on his own struggles with mental health. Thanks again so much for tuning in. Now, here's the episode. All right, so hello, Edie and Ronan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi. Yeah.
No problem.
Cool.
This was very short notice, so thank you so much for making the time. So, and specifically, I brought you on to speak about diabulimia and your specific experience with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just kind of understanding of it, because it's a relatively new topic, but I think it's one very important one to discuss, because I think it probably affects a lot more people than they even realize. And I think I've actually, that's kind of the common theme that I've heard, is like people realize that they've had it years afterwards, years after they've gone through it. So yeah, so this is, hopefully this conversation kind of shine a light on it and get a bit more specific about it and maybe help people figure out what they're going through. So, as we always do, we start with introductions, and Edie, as our type 1, will go first, because that's how numbers work. And so, if you could, please tell us about yourself, what you're doing, where you are in life, a little bit about, you know, what's going on in Edie's life, but also your diagnosis story.
Cool. Hello, my name is Edie. I'm a type 1 from Northern Ireland, so I live in a little place called Portadown that not many people know about. I love living in Northern Ireland, it's pretty great. Yeah, I live with my partner slash boyfriend, Ronan.
Hello.
I'm also an artist and illustrator, and I've just recently graduated from university. I was over in university in England studying fine arts. And I actually used a lot of my diabetes in my art and still do. And that's kind of where I started exploring my diabetes and mental health a lot more, was when I went to university. We both actually went to university at the same time
together.
Yeah, so that was really nice. We've just moved into our first house, which is really nice. We're here 5 days,
yes.
4 days. So that's why it's really echoey. But it's lovely. It's nice to have a routine again, because for months we were just out of routine.
Although the takeaways
have been great.
Have been common.
Yeah,
quite often now because we've just moved in.
Yeah. It's like it's been a weird like year nearly. It's mad to think it has actually been a year as well.
Yeah,
so I guess that's where I'm at. Yeah, I'm just working away, doing my artist stuff, trying to manage my diabetes best I can.
And how long have you had your type 1? How long ago were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed 10 years ago, October 31st of this year. I know, Halloween.
Halloween, yeah.
It's actually quite a funny story. Like, I was trick-or-treating at my friend's house, and I was dressed as Harry Potter. And, like,
Duh.
Full gear. Like, I went all in, and I was dressed as like Harry Potter, and we just got back from trick-or-treating. And a few days prior, I went to go in to get the blood test done to see if I was diabetic. So I would have been 11 or 12. And I didn't think I was diabetic at all. I thought, because my life at that point was so, everything was going perfectly. Yeah. So I just didn't think that it would happen to me, because you hear about things happening to everybody around you, but you never think it's actually going to happen to you. So I thought, no, I'm not diabetic, like, chill. And my mum was in Dublin, and we don't live anywhere near Dublin. So I was at my friend's house, got the phone call at like 12 o'clock at night on 31st of Halloween to rush me to the hospital. So yeah, it was like literally like the middle of Halloween. Oogie spooky.
The witching hour, as they call it, yeah.
Yes. And I was all by myself in the hospital, dressed as Harry Potter, in the children's ward, like waiting for my mum to get back from Dublin, and my dad was in London. So that was fun. So it's been 10 years, yeah.
Wow, that's I've never heard of anybody, adults being by themselves, you know, because you're, you know, in your 20s or 30s, and mm-hmm. that's your parents aren't around. But yeah. You're 12 and on your own. That's, and you're dressed as Harry Potter. Funny. So yeah.
Yeah. It, like, I was with my friend's mum, whose granny, so my friend's granny was actually type 1 diabetic, and she was the only person I'd ever met with type 1, and they were actually the people that told my mum, oh, we think Edie has diabetes, because she's drinking like an immense amount of water, like, and I lost, I think, like 2 stone, which I don't know if that's the same weight as American people use. I lost a lot of weight.
Like 20, 14 pounds?
Yeah, 14 pounds, yeah. Maybe, so I'd lost 2 stones, like 28 pounds? It's like a lot.
A big amount.
Yeah.
for the size you were, it was a large proportion of your total body weight.
I was a chubby kid, so I don't think people were worried who didn't know me, because I was a chubby kid. So they just thought I was like growing out of that stage of life. But I'm kind of sidetracking a bit. Yeah. Yeah, Halloween, ookie spooky.
No, yeah. So how was that afterwards? And like, kind of like mm-hmm. how I kind of suggested earlier, you realized, so you went through diabulimia, but you didn't really realize that you had gone through it until years later. So mm-hmm. talk to us about that. So like, what was your type 1 after that?
So I'm an only child, so my mom and dad didn't actually have like any other children to kind of compare what it was like bringing me up to. So they're absolutely brilliant. Like my mom especially was brilliant, but she just didn't know what things were normal and what things weren't normal. Yeah, like what to look out for. So when it came to the diabetes, she felt like she'd done something wrong, I think, and that's why I had it, until she like fully understood the whole ins and outs of type 1. And when I got diagnosed, because I was at that stage of my life where I was about to go through puberty and like I was getting older, I was already a very anxious kid and I was starting school. And to make things even more interesting, I went to a boarding school. So that had a little bit of spice. I basically just like couldn't deal with diabetes on top of all that. And if we're really going to go into it, I thought I was like queer in the middle of it all, and it just like got so like stressful for me. So I just didn't want to like be diabetic, and I think I did what a lot of diabetics do and just was like, nope, that's something I'm going to put on the shelf and I'm going to deal with that later. And I just didn't look after myself right. I was really embarrassed as well. Like I just didn't want to eat in front of people. I didn't want to check my blood sugars. It was like in the days as well where like a CGM wasn't a thing. It was like unheard of. So you had to do your blood sugars like 8 times a day. And if you didn't, you were like the worst diabetic in the world. So I just felt under so much pressure. And because my mum was just taking the advice of like the nurses and the doctors, she unknowingly, I think, put pressure on me by accident, just because she wanted what was best for me, which put me under more pressure. And I think that kind of made me be like, no, I'm not diabetic. I don't need to deal with this. And then before I actually got diagnosed, I was bullied in school for being chubby. So I had a lot of problems with what I looked like at that age when I just started secondary school, which is like high school in America, isn't it? Or I guess middle school. Like I went to a really Francisco, and it was just like, it was too much. But because of the whole not really liking my body and stuff at that age before my diagnosis, I definitely didn't see my weight loss because of the diabetes, because it happened so fast. So I literally went from being like a UK 14 to like a UK 8, which is like quite a big difference for dress sizes anyway, within a very short period of time, whilst also dealing with like body dysmorphia. And I didn't see my, like, what I actually looked like. So I definitely thought after I was diagnosed that I looked a lot bigger. And I think that, and people still bullied me in school for being chubby, even when I wasn't chubby, because they knew it got to me. I could just tell, now looking back, I could tell people were just trying to push my buttons. But in the headspace at that time, I thought, oh my God, I'm really fat, I'm disgusting, like I need to lose weight. And I knew that because the doctors had told me that you lose weight if you like eat and don't take insulin, I remember thinking, oh, I could just like not take as much. And that's how like it started. So I started maybe eating like a pizza, and if the carbs, we're going to get into carb cutting, if the carbs were like 45 grams and my ratio was like 1 to 10, I was supposed to take 4.5, I would have took like 2 units and just seen where it went from there. And like, I did not tell anybody about it because I thought like, oh, it's not weird. Like, it's just people don't take their tablets. Like, I put it on the same level as that.
Yeah, it is. That's something that's really interesting because it reminds me. So I saw the docuseries. I'm not sure you probably saw it too. The BBC kind of 1 hour documentary on diabulimia. And one of the, they were all women. I think it was about five. And they,
yeah, I've seen it. It's brilliant.
One of them mentioned specifically how, like, the doctor said, if you take insulin, it, there's an effect of it is that you gain weight. And so that clicked a switch in her head to make it seem like, oh, if I don't take it, then I'll lose weight. And that's just basically put those two and two together eventually. Because, like, you, one of the symptoms of, like, pre-diagnosis is extreme weight loss. And so, like, I can see how that, like, that coupled with anxiety and, like, body image issues, you know, it's a perfect storm for what we call now diabulimia. It almost sounds textbook, at least now. Yeah, like, looking back on it, it's like, oh, wow, that's exactly what happened.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for coming on to talk about that.
That's fine.
Now, Ronan, tell us about yourself, what you're doing in life, and then also how you know Edie, but also how you met Edie's type 1. You guys live together now, so, like, I'm guessing you have a pretty good understanding of what she goes through with it.
Well, I try to. It's very complicated. It is very complicated to try and learn that stuff, but, like, I just do my best to sort of...
I think when it's not happening to you, it's, like, very difficult.
But I'm Ronan. I'm Edie's partner. We met at the interview for university, and we went to university together. I'm an animator. Currently, well, I'm...
You're an animator.
Yeah, well, I'm working part-time. I've not done much animating. I found out that Edie was diabetic on our first date. And we went to this little restaurant called Bagel Bean, and she said that she had to go and inject insulin. And I was like, what's that for? Because my exposure to diabetes was from the media and TV shows, where only big, fat old men had diabetes, you know, diabetes.
It was completely joked about.
Yeah. So that was my exposure to it, so I was quite taken aback whenever you said that you had diabetes, and I was like, but I thought that was for like really old men.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think that it was that bad of a big of a deal. Like, I didn't think that it was just a like thing you just get and just live with it.
Yeah.
But obviously it's far more than that. And throughout our relationship I learned more and more and more and more. And no, I wouldn't say that I'm a professional, but I'd say I'm pretty good.
Yeah, so you're pretty good. Like, you've helped, like, this is slightly different, but, like, I used to take seizures a lot as a 16-year-old. I don't mind talking about that. It's to do with my diabetes. My mum was very worried about it after, like, I started getting older. And when I was 18, I had kind of stopped having them, but there was still that fear that I would have them in my sleep. So Ronan was really good about checking my Freestyle Libre, you know, whenever I went to sleep, and he was just absolutely amazing at, like, at like just kind of being like, yeah, this is something that EDA has, and I can choose whether to accept it or just be like, nope, I'm not dealing with it.
Well, it's kind of like we'll kind of work together on it because like we both suffer from mental health issues. I suffer from depression, and you're very understanding about that. So you helped me out with that. It's not the same thing, obviously, but like we work good as a team.
Yeah.
With all of our issues, we sort of mold them together.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Now that's a nice way of looking at it. Like you're a team. Yeah. Like you're handling these things together, which I think is something that, at least for me, I've had my type 1 for 20 years, and that was always something that I struggled with conceiving, like somebody that would willingly take on my type 1. Not thinking that it's like, it's not something that they have to take on. It's something that they help with. So at least, you know, now I have that understanding. But yeah, that is something that's really nice to hear. And so now, so Edie, I actually saw this on your Instagram, how you are actually, so now you're an ambassador for the Eating Disorder Association in, is it European?
Is it it's UK? Northern Ireland.
Okay. So how did that come about? And then how did you, I guess we should start with how you found out you had diabulimia. Because like how you were saying, it's not something that you were told at the time. It's something that you kind of discovered later on after you like explained to people what was going on. It's like, oh, that's actually what that was. Yeah. Which I think is something that is common nowadays. People are older now and they realize that like, oh no, I had diabulimia when I was in middle school, high school. So tell us about that process and like what that was like realizing that you had this thing, that you had this thing that you didn't have a name for at the time. Was it helpful? Was it sad? Like how did that go?
Yeah.
What was that like?
I'm definitely someone that likes to put a label on something and be like, that's what that is. So whether it's like my sexuality or diabetes, diabulimia, it really helps me. So in about 2017, I watched the BBC documentary, I think, or it could have been later. I watched the BBC documentary of the about diabulimia, and I remember thinking, oh my God, these people have like exactly what I had, just they're being hospitalized for it. And I was just coming out of it at that stage as well. So I remember thinking, oh my God, I've done that all by myself. Like I've dragged myself out of that myself, and there's people like dealing with it. And so I watched that and then kind of didn't think anything else of it. And then about 6 months to a year ago, I started being friendly with this girl who suffered with bulimia online and talks openly about it on Instagram. Her name's Colette, and her Instagram's Cosmic Colette. She's from Northern Ireland. She works for Eating Disorders Association NI. And we spoke on and off about eating disorders because I was really curious to learn more about eating disorders because I thought I didn't know really anybody with them. And then the more I spoke to her about it, she goes, oh, you should become an ambassador for it because it's really good to have ambassadors that actually don't have eating disorders to get like a fresh perspective. And I thought, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And then literally in like the same week when I was speaking to my mental health team through my doctor, I spoke to them about all the stuff I had went through as a teenager and how I can, like all the diabulimia that I didn't know was diabulimia and how I could see myself kind of going back to it a bit, but not nearly as bad. They said to me, oh, what you have or had is diabulimia. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, that's what it is. Like, but they didn't give me any help or anything. They just gave me a name for it.
But that's all you really needed, isn't it?
Yeah, like for me personally, like it really just helped. So I started doing like research on it and realized that like 40% of adults with type 1 suffer with like symptoms of diabulimia. And I think it's 4 out of 10 women will like ration their insulin to lose weight. So there's a lot of, or 4 out of 10 diabetic women will ration their insulin to lose weight specifically. And there was just so many people that have had symptoms of it or been diagnosed with it, but like not enough awareness spread of it. So I kind of said to Colette, I went back to her and said, by the way, plot twist, I've got an eating disorder have had an eating disorder, and I'm going to be talking to this to my counsellor whenever I get referred to this about it a bit more to kind of work through it. Could we do like a post about it? And she was like, yes, of course. Like, I've heard about it. There's nothing on the website about it. We need this to go out there. And it just perfectly coincided with Diabetes Awareness Month. as well. So it was like everything was lining up. Like there was all these little like things just lining up.
Planets aligned.
Yeah, the planets aligned. And she just goes to me, yeah, you write something about it, write like a fact sheet, get a photo of yourself, make it all jazzy, we'll post it up. And I got like a really big, like for that page, because it got like the most liked post on that page, because usually they only get like 15 likes, because it is a smaller page, they're trying to build it up. And I got like 90 likes, and we were so surprised, just because there's no hashtags or anything on it, I don't think. So we were like, oh yes, get in. So it made us really happy to think that like people responded really well to someone having like a story rather than just like random posts.
Mm-hmm.
As for having diabulimia, it's still kind of strange to say that I've had it, because like I obviously didn't go to therapy for it. I kind of got myself out of it, and I would still think that I have certain tendencies that simulate it.
You still have tendencies of somebody that has an eating disorder.
Yeah, definitely.
I will notice it sometimes if I'm late home or whatever, yeah. You won't have eaten anything.
No, you
have like in the past year said that you're not going to take insulin because you don't want to put on weight.
Yeah, like I've said it a lot and thought about it, and that to be honest, one of the things that kind of stops me is thinking about how in other countries, like people don't have access to insulin, and it really puts it in perspective. And I'm like, Edie, Mia, wise up, like stop what you're doing, you know, don't be treating it like that, you know. It's just so hard to get out of that mindset, especially when you haven't had like proper clinical therapy yet, I think.
Yeah, Ronan, as someone from like looking on from the outside in, what has that been like? And I guess what was your understanding of that, as you know, Edie was, because I'm assuming you were there when Edie kind of realized that diabulimia is what she went through, or were you two together at that point? Or this was recently, right?
It wasn't that long ago.
It was only a few months ago. Yeah, so Ronan, what was that like? And then did it put anything into perspective, or like?
Well, see, she had told me midway through our relationship that you used to do that.
Yeah.
We didn't know what diabulimia was at this point. But you told me that you used to do that, and then whenever you came home and said that you had this, I was like, well, that sort of all makes sense.
Yeah,
it all sort of clicked, because she said this ages ago, and it was known in our relationship that she used to do this, and then we found out what this was, because you were doing the whole thing with it, and then you got you found out that you actually had it, and it sort of just was like, yeah.
It was quite bittersweet, to be honest, because it was like, oh yeah, it's an awful thing to have, but I'm so glad that it's just kind of put things in perspective, because I just didn't really see anybody else publicly speaking about it or like on Instagram. Like I use Instagram a lot for my diabetes, just because I don't really have anyone in real life to talk to about it who has diabetes. I only know, like, friendship wise one other person, and they don't really like to talk about it. He hasn't really come to terms with it himself. But so online was a really big important thing to me, and over time I noticed less and less people sharing like authentic stories, and it kind of affected my mental health a bit, because I felt like what I was going through like wasn't valid, and that it was like not dirty, but like,
yeah,
dirty is a good word to use. Like I just felt like a bit wrong, but I couldn't stop myself from doing it.
Taboo, very taboo.
Because I just couldn't, like, I'm someone that really, like, I love whenever I see, like, famous people, like, say, like, oh, you know, Nick Jonas, if you're listening. Like, I love that he's, like, now becoming more open with it, you know, with diabetes. And, like, the girl that plays Harper from Wizards of Waverly Place, like, I was obsessed with her. She was like my style icon, and she's a nurse and a type 1. Like, I love all that. So whenever I saw nobody talking about it, I was like, oh God, I'm weird. Like, this is weird. Yeah.
And Ronan, from your perspective, from knowing Edie as long as you have, did it put anything into perspective, or did it, like you said, it clicked? What were the things that you noticed before the click? Did it help you, or did it give you any kind of context for anything? Like, what was that like, knowing this about Edie and knowing that she had gone through this at one point?
Well, it was a while ago that it was going on, but it was always sort of there that there might be some sort of issue that with food, because we sort of thought maybe you would have, because she's still very insecure about her body. But I think that's normal for women, a lot of women do with it, but
you used to always say to me that you couldn't understand why I was so insecure.
Yeah.
But like it all sort of made sense.
Whenever we found this out, because somebody obviously has eating disorder or anything like that whenever they're younger, like it's gonna
affect them.
It's gonna affect them later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
So especially with someone with body dysmorphia as well.
Yeah.
I would say, so whenever we found out, it was sort of like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But at the same time, we deal with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really...
Yeah, I agree.
Like, it wasn't a massive impact whenever we found out what it was.
Like, a lot has happened to do with my health in the past 2 years. I think anyone that feels like they have it, like, definitely get help as soon as possible, because even if you don't get the full diagnosis of having diabulimia, you can still have tendencies that lean towards it. You don't need to have, like, the full, you know, you don't have to need to check the
test. You don't need to check every box.
Yeah, like, you just, you know what I mean? Like, you're completely entitled to get help, because at the end of the day, like, it's so common, so that, I don't know if that's going to make everyone feel more calm, but for me, it made me feel a lot calmer to know that it's like one less thing I have to kind of worry about, and that it's one less thing that I don't have to worry about, that when I go to my counsellor, I can tell them and they know how to deal with it now. Because when I was going through it, it like pretty much was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't a thing. And I got accused a lot of actually self-harming as a young diabetic, which it's kind of complicated. I got accused of self-harming with insulin, like taking too much insulin, which I was never doing, and I stand by that. Like, I never did that, but like they thought that, yeah.
Just for context, how long ago was this?
When I was 13 to 16.
What year was that? Would that have been?
2011 till 2015.
Okay, yeah, so you know, it's not relatively recently, but yeah, so like you're saying, diabulimia is kind of just coming on the scene, I guess you could say. People are just becoming aware of it. So like, you know, 5 years ago, it didn't exist, you know, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't rely on that diagnosis as to like, this is the reason why things are happening the way they are, which I think goes to the next thing I wanted to ask you. So like, what was the process of like, was there like a point where you can say it's like, oh, this is when it started? Is like, what was it like throughout? Then how did you find yourself getting through it? When did it stop, I guess you could say?
I definitely noticed it whenever I was in boarding school, because I lived in like a school for 5 days out of the week and then went home on the weekends. So the school provided me with my meals, provided me with like all that sort of stuff, and it was a lot of pressure because I went to boarding school, I had to eat with a lot of people. So I had to eat with like 200 people. And because it was like all the fine seating and stuff as well, so I didn't like taking my insulin at the dinner table, because it was one thing that people would like make fun of me of. And I noticed it started there, because I just wouldn't take insulin before my meal. I'd be like, no, I'm not taking insulin. I think a lot of diabetics do that. They take their insulin afterwards.
I did that
for years. Like, I did that up until I was about 18.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did that for years.
Well, you did that on our first date.
Yeah, I just couldn't. Yeah,
I remember you doing that on our first date. Because you actually went to the bathroom to take your insulin.
I was really embarrassed. And I guess that's where it started from. It started from me being like, yeah, I'm going to eat this, but I'm going to take my correct amount of insulin just after the meal. So then as the bullying just kept getting worse, because I wasn't able to like stand up for myself, and I think people saw that as my weakness, so they just kind of poked at me more. And it got to the point where everyone was kind of like growing into like beautiful young women. So I was like, I'm so fat. Hi. So I was like, I need to find a way to like lose weight. And I remember thinking, like, if I just don't take enough insulin for like my meals, I can still enjoy my meal and lose weight. And in my head, it made so much sense, even though it's so dangerous. Like, it just made perfect sense to my little 13-year-old self. So I started from there, and I noticed people would compliment me on my weight loss. People saying, you're looking really well. And that, you know, I can't wrong those people for complimenting me because they didn't know, but that in my head meant you're doing the right thing. You know, you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, it reinforced it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of verified it in my head. Like, yeah, this is good job. So the times where I would doubt myself for doing it, thinking maybe this is a bad idea. If someone said, oh, you're looking real like skinny today, or those jeans look really skinny on you or whatever, I would think, oh, brilliant, like it's working. Like, and the one thing I want to like really, what's the word, like emphasize is that I think a lot of diabetics, especially people who are diagnosed young, think that all these complications aren't going to happen for like a million years down the line, because you feel like invincible when you're young. And it's kind of funny because when people would tell me, like my doctors, nurses, if you don't take your insulin correctly, if you do X, Y, Z, you know, you're going to lose your sight. You're going to lose loss of feeling in your feet. And I would just sit and think, no, I won't. I'll be fine. And I think a lot of diabetics do that. And I just thought that. I thought, you know, I don't feel this way today, so I don't need to worry about that. You know, the repercussions, they're not going to hit me. I felt the same way I did before I got diagnosed, like, oh, that's not going to happen to me. And then whenever I eventually did get my diabetic eye screening, and I got like the retinopathy. I got that. I had it. It said in my letter, like when I was about 17, that I had it. And that was when I was like, oh God, I need to really like stop it and like stop what I'm doing. So I just want to make sure, like, I don't want people waiting that long to like realize that what they're doing is dangerous. Mm. Like, I had to have it sitting in front of me after I'd done the damage. Mm.
Looking you in the face, yeah.
Yeah, literally.
No, that sounds like a lot of, and not even necessarily just diabulimia, just like extreme burnout. That's another realization. There's another story I heard recently of a woman. She was like in 19, 17, or, you know, in that age range. At college, and she was on her own and, you know, taking care of herself, you know, in quotes. And the doctor, you know, told her, is like, you're going to lose your sight by 30, like, if you keep on going down this path. And that, like, woke her up. And that's basically, she got scared straight into taking care of herself. You know, it's difficult to kind of hear that because, like, what if she didn't go to the eye doctor that year, or, like, just, like, pushed it off? Because, you know, that's something I do. I don't go to the eye doctor every year just because I forget. And it's not something I think about all the time.
Yeah.
And that brought up, you mentioned something about people commenting on how you looked skinnier. From my perspective, personally, like, every time I hear a woman describe her diagnosis or like the, you know, the symptoms before it, and especially if they're over 18, they're always told that they're looking skinny or they're getting skinnier. It's like, everybody's telling them that they look great. And and they always say, it's like, oh, wow. It's like, I'm, you know, I hit the jackpot. Like, I'm eating all this food. Cause like, one of the things is like, if you're blood sugar is high enough, your body wants you to keep on eating because it's not absorbing any of those, you know, carbs or anything. So like, you appetite increases, but you don't gain any weight. So it's like, oh wow, like I'm winning. Like, you know, I won the genetic lottery kind of thing. And so they don't necessarily see it as a negative. They see it as a positive. And I'm not sure if you've ever noticed that, or if like, if you've heard that, or like if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, that was like when I got diagnosed, I didn't really think that way just because I was so young. So,
that's why I mentioned like over 18. Cause like that's the age when I think, you know, I don't know, people think it's appropriate to like make those kinds of comments.
Yeah.
When you're 12, it's not something that's like in the forefront of your mind, but I don't know, like having had your type one for as long as you have had it, I don't know if you've noticed those things or if like it, if it's something that.
Yeah,
like,
no, definitely.
Yeah. Well, like any thoughts on that?
I know for me, like whenever I've been in like really, really bad places, I might look to some people like really good because like obviously you lose weight and I think for me as well, like whenever I'm having a bad time, when I go out into public, I actually put like more makeup on. I make more effort to kind of mask how crap I feel. So like looking back in photos, especially at university, I look really great, but oh my God, I was in such a bad place. Like, it's insane. And like, I'm in such a good place. Well, I'm in a good place now. I just like struggle with, you know, my mental health, but I don't look like, if you were to put all of my year by year photos together, what maybe someone would pick as my best.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, some people might think, no, you look better in like 2015, but like, I feel so much better now. And I think there's such an emphasis on like women, especially. Like, if you look skinny, like you're thriving, which is so dangerous, not only for like diabetics, but for people in general, because of eating disorders. And that's where like a lot of eating disorders kind of stem from. Like, I've talked to a few people now who've suffered from eating disorders, and they always say like they started it, they kind of tested the water, and then they started getting compliments, and then realized, oh, I'm doing the right thing because I'm getting compliments on how I look. So it just kind of goes to show that, like, yeah, it's like, it's very real, it's very scary, like, that you just don't know what someone's going through.
Yeah, that idea that skinny is healthy and fat, you know, in quotes, is unhealthy. Yeah, and it's scary to think about, because it's not something that guys generally deal with. And ironically, kind of, I don't know, maybe ironically or just societally, it's the opposite for guys. Like, if a guy is getting smaller quickly and, like, you know, noticeably, that's like a sign that, like, oh no, something's happening. It's not like we don't look better when we're skinnier, kind of thing. And it's just kind of like that double standard where it's the same exact symptom, but like for women, it's somehow better to be skinnier, to get skinnier quickly. Whereas for men, it's, you know, it's a sign of like something's wrong. You need to get checked out. And
it's like a weakness, nearly.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know.
Well, it goes back to like gender roles and stuff, doesn't it?
Like, oh, yeah. 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 And I wonder if like there's women out there that like held off going to the doctor because of that. Because like people kept on telling them that they look so great, even though they probably didn't feel as great as like people were telling them that they looked. And I guess that's my next question for you, Edie, is like, how did you feel throughout that? Because I know personally, I don't feel like I could go be high for very long, because it's just a terrible feeling. And so like, I can't imagine going for like a weeks or weeks on end at like 300 or 400, which is like what I've heard. And so like, how did that feel for you? And the other thing is like, the scary thing about the human body is like, you can get used to that. Like, you can get used to sitting at 300 for a while if you do it for long enough.
Yeah.
So like, what was that like for you specifically?
That's like such a good point, because like, oh, how do I even go into this? I remember my diabetes really wasn't under control until I turned about 18, maybe 19, and I'm 21 now, so that's not that long, and it's still not where I want it to be at. But because it was out of control for so long, whenever I kind of went through those periods where I was like, yeah, I'm going to knuckle down, I'm going to make this better, I felt really low all the time, because I was sitting at like 5, which is like 100, isn't it?
Yeah.
So like when I was sitting at like...
5 is like 90. Like a good... Yeah.
Is it? Yeah, when I was sitting at like a good level, I felt really shaky, because I was so used to being at like skyrocket. And I hated the feeling. So I was like, no, screw this. I'm just going to coast at like 15. And I can still lose weight. So even though I wasn't, like, I went through a whole period where I would literally sit at, my blood sugar would be so high that it would just tell me I was high. It wouldn't even say a number. I would just do that for like days on end. And I felt crap. Like, I couldn't walk. The amount of water I was drinking was insane. Like, we had like lockers in our school, and I used to get like a drink, like a full bottle at lunchtime, chuck it into the locker, and then like when you open my locker, just bottles poured out, because I drank so much water. I ran to the toilet constantly. There was times like in my sleep where I would wet the bed because it was so bad, which I know is quite common. And I had headaches all the time. Like, my hair got really thin, my eyesight got really poor. Like, I haven't always worn glasses. I used to never wear glasses, so things like that. Like, I just felt awful, but I just kind of ignored it, because I was mentally so not there. I was like on autopilot, that I just didn't really let myself feel what I was feeling. I just kind of was like focusing on like being skinny. I was always like focusing on the goal instead of like listening to my body.
Yeah, it's something that I've heard too, like not necessarily just for women, but like people that run high a lot will tend to feel low at like 100, which is kind of like the average where you, for us at least, 100 is where you want to be. Like that's kind of like an optimal place to be at least. But for some people, if you run high for long enough, that feels low. And like your body isn't used to being in like the optimal, you know, average range, which is scary because like, you know, we can get used to that. And the longer you're in that danger zone of being high all the time, the more complications come up. Like you said, like when you went to the eye doctor at 17, like you're going to go blind in, you know, however many years.
Yeah.
So it's scary. The human body is really good at telling you what's wrong, but also can be really bad at telling you what's wrong.
Yeah.
And then you have all these like, you know, reinforcements from the people around you. It's like, oh, you're looking great. Like you're looking so skinny.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's kind of a losing battle, especially when you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And you don't have any kind of examples to lean on and to look at is like diabulimia. Because like you said, diabulimia didn't exist like in the, you know, the mental space or like the mental health space. It wasn't something that people suffered from. So like, how can you diagnose that and treat it?
It also doesn't help. Like I wrote this line on my notes. This is like, this was a big pivotal moment for me. It doesn't help that when I was at school, a lot of the media that we were like, a lot of the TV shows we were watching, movies we were watching, glamorized bulimia and anorexia so much, and like being really skinny. Like I can think of a handful, like Bridget Jones's Diary is like one, like that glamorized like trying to lose weight. And like I can't think of stuff at the top of my head, but I just remember like people that looked like me in media were always like the fat character, like even people that weren't fat, like just like mid-sized people. And that was such a big thing like back in like that time. Like I know it was only a few years ago, but it really has changed a lot. And in my school, like bulimia was like, there was people with bulimia and it was like trendy. Like it was like, oh yeah, like she's really good at like doing it. Like, and like it just wasn't a big deal at all. Like, so I thought, oh, I have like platinum bulimia. I have, this is such a dark joke, but like I have like better bulimia because I don't even have to be sick. I can just like eat what I want. Like that's such a dark way to think about it, that's how I thought about it. And it's just, it's like the media has such an impact on me as a young diabetic, like such a huge, like social media really saved my life in a way, like it really did. Like I started posting about my diabetes about 3-4 years ago and it properly saved my life. Like it just encouraged me so much to get my shit together.
And Ronan, since you were there when Edie discovered social media, like did you notice any changes from like before and after? I'm not sure if you were there before, but
major change, like a huge change. And Edie, like she would come home every day and sit in her car for a good hour crying her eyes out every single day. And then whenever she got into the social media thing and met those people, like none of that. She's such a happier person being part of the community, and a quite a big part of the community, I would say. And you have like a hand in things. Like you're not just sort of a watcher. So yeah, I definitely noticed a massive change there whenever she got into social media.
I think a big pivotal moment.
The biggest change though is that you sit on your phone for far longer now than you used to.
My people need to know what I'm at.
You need to tell your fans what's going on.
Exactly. I was talking to who was it? She has Maddie. Her name's Kylie.
Yeah, she was on the
I
show
love her.
A couple weeks ago. Yeah,
she's so cute. I love her. And I said like something about that, and she was like, "Yeah, my husband always makes fun of me about like being like my fans need to know what I'm doing." I was like, "They don't get it, Kylie." Yeah, she's cool. Yeah, it's just like things like that, like what I just said there. Like it's just small things. Like people just getting small things. Like social media, it can be bad, but like I think this
area, the sort of community that you're in, like there's obviously there's one a big community and then there's sort of like little branches off, and the community, the branch that you guys are sitting on is isn't it sort of toxic branch. It's very, very
yeah, it's
comfortable.
Yeah.
It's very nice. From what I've seen, anyway.
Yeah, and then Ronan, throughout your knowing Edie, because it sounds like you met her maybe shortly after, shortly during her realization of diabulimia and kind of trying to get on top of her type 1 a little bit better. Is there anything that you've noticed over the course of like knowing Edie that kind of like makes you think about eating disorders or her diabulimia specifically? And like, I don't know if anything like maybe you two have even had like conversations about things to look out for. So like to make sure that Edie isn't kind of like regressing or going back on things. Like, I'm not sure if there's any like telltale signs or like things that you notice that she might do that maybe concern you or anything like basically anything that maybe somebody in a relationship with someone with an eating disorder or diabulimia could look out for, or like maybe ways of like going about it.
Yeah. That could be helpful. I always sort of try and look out for the body dysmorphia pop on its head. Like if she says, "Oh, I've put on 2 stone," I'm like, you could not have possibly put on 2 stone within a day. Like, that doesn't happen. You can't do that. So I have to sort of talk her out of that and get her through that. And because obviously, you know, how your weight changes throughout the day, it's that thing gets her a lot. And it's the body dysmorphia that I look out for, because I know that if the body dysmorphia gets her, then she'll think about it over and over and over.
Do you know another thing as well? I think it's like pushed me into nearly a burnout / diabulimia like symptoms is being too focused on my blood sugars. So like about a year ago, I got on my insulin pump, and I was so on it. I checked my blood sugars like every half.
It was like, you know the way whenever you get a new phone or something, you sit on it and learn everything about it for like a week and you don't want to set it down. It was like that.
Like, it took me 9 years to get my pump. It took me going to university to get my insulin pump, because in the UK, depends on like the area you're in, like what county, it's so difficult to get on your pump, and there's a lot of criteria you have to meet. So in Northern Ireland, the criteria is you have to have really good control to like win that luxury. And I think it's changed now, but that's what it was like. And they kept saying like, no, you don't have enough control.
That's what it is for older people, but younger people are trying to start out on pump.
When I went to uni, my nurses in England took one look at me and said, you need to go on a pump. And I remember thinking, okay, this is my chance to fresh start, change it about. And my HbA1c went from like 10 to 5 in like 6 months. But they told me it was too tight. I was like, what the fuck? I don't know if I can swear. Can I swear?
I was like, please
what
do.
The fuck? Like what? Like what? Do. I was so annoyed. I was like, what do you want from me? And that just, because I tried so hard to be like goody two shoes about it. Because I had so much shit handed to me by my team in Northern Ireland that I was like so determined to make myself like perfect. And I made a really good impression with them. They just told me my HbA1c was a bit too low. And that settled me the wrong way. I was like, right, no, you can either take it or leave it, hon. And I just was like, nope. And I just kind of was like, no, back to basics. I'm sitting at coasting at 13, because that means I'm not too high, I'm not too low, like I don't have to worry about it. And I just burned out completely because of how tight my control was. And I am at fault a bit, because I didn't tell my team that I was struggling with like eating.
But they didn't give you much other reason, because they weren't a great team.
They weren't a great team. My Northern Irish team were very poor, and I've talked to loads of people about this.
Only really now you have a good team.
Yeah. Like, it was
sorry,
so poor.
What does that mean? Purr?
My team?
What is that?
It's like diabetic nurses and stuff like that.
No, so you said purr. Is that a word?
Oh, poor, bad.
Oh, poor.
Like,
sorry. Okay. Oh. Sorry. Sorry. You were saying the right word. Okay. It's just, I didn't understand it.
It's the accent, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was like a, you know, slang or like, but you were saying poor. Okay. Yeah.
Poor. Yeah. Yeah. I don't even remember what I was
they
saying.
They were a bad team.
Yeah, they weren't great. They were very.
And only now you've got a good team.
Yeah. The team, like, I don't mean to throw anybody under the bus, but we're crap. And I've said this to them. Like, I said to my GP that I feel as if I have like a little bit of trauma from the years of when I got diagnosed, because the team was very hurtful to me, because they kind of didn't know whether to treat me as a kid or like a teenager. And they would be comparing my experience and journey to like other people who were doing just fine, and be like, why can't you be like such and such? And I was so shy and so filled with anxiety that I didn't know how to tell this team what I was going through, because of how like harsh they were being. And I didn't find that helpful at all. So yeah, like that, it kind of leads back to what I said a while ago about they kind of thought that I was self-harming by injecting insulin to make myself go low, which I've never done. Like, I would have said by now, you know what I mean? Like, I've talked about everything else, why would I? I've never done it, but they kind of were like, you're doing this. And because I was having really bad hypos, which induced me into a seizure. And because they didn't believe me, it just like made me not trust them. And it gave me a bad relationship with them and my diabetes, because they didn't trust me.
Yeah, care teams are, you know, here in the States too, it's very kind of, it's like luck of the draw. Like, some people have great teams, and it can really color your type 1 management, like positively or negatively. Some people are scared of their care teams or like their doctors. We don't really have teams here, I would say. We have doctors. It's just the one person. It can be traumatizing. Like, they can make you feel like you're not doing a good job, and then you're anxious to go to the endo, and you're scared to go, and you're scared what number, because like sometimes they'll give you shit for it. They'll like, you know, chastise you for it. And or like the people that have like great A1Cs, like they have to go above and beyond, and it's not like a sustainable lifestyle to get that like 5.5 number. Like, there was one story I heard from a woman. She was a collegiate athlete, like very high level, competitive, and like she had a 5.5 A1C, but she had to like struggle with it. And it was about, she was like counting every single carb that she ate. She didn't eat anything over a certain amount every day. It was like very taxing on her to do that. And when she went into the doctor, and like her doctor says, like, wow, you're amazing. Like, you're my star patient. Like, I wish I could like bottle up whatever you're doing and give it to all my other patients. And she felt so terrible, like physically and mentally, that it was just not sustainable. And like, it's dangerous that I think it's sad that we put so much stock into those numbers, because like you can get to very good numbers in a very unhealthy way. And it can kind of like lead to like what you were saying, like burnout, like just like, you know, fuck it. I'm just not going to care anymore, because like it took so much to get to that 5.5 or whatever number your doctor deems to be acceptable, even though it's, you know, very unhealthy way of getting there. So so I think, care teams can have a really big impact on how you view your type 1 and how you deal with it or manage it. And like, so I think you mentioned how like you talk to your counselors and they mentioned like, oh yeah, you definitely had diabulimia. Since you found out that that's what it was, and your involvement with as an ambassador for the Eating Disorder Association, what have you been able to learn about eating disorders that you find helpful, or like puts like things that you went through as a kid into context, or like that?
It definitely comforts me to know that any time I feel bad about my body, it's not really me. It's kind of more a result of not having the proper care after discovering I had, or like not having the proper care to deal with diabetes, if that makes sense. And that brings me a lot of comfort. And I don't think I have been as bad. Would you say I've been as bad with my body? Like, I don't think I have been just as bad. Because I used to be really bad and be like, I'm disgusting. And be like, I must be disgusting because there's nothing like wrong with my eating habits.
Yeah, good days and bad days.
Yeah, like everybody, have good days and bad days. But meeting the team with the eating disorder team, Colette specifically, has helped me hugely, because she's about the same size. Well, she's very tall, which I never knew until I met her in life. But we're like the same size gals. We're like, you know, we both interested in the same things, and like, now that I know that I've suffered with diabetes and she suffered with bulimia, it's nice knowing that there's someone else there to talk to. And I know it's not the exact same thing, but it's really nice to know that like someone was in the same headspace as me, like similar headspace, and that I wasn't like a freak. Because I just felt so like, because none of my friends who were girls at the time where I had my diabetes had any problems physically. I don't know if they had, like, maybe their mental health they were dealing with, but, like, I need a community. Like,
you're stronger together.
Yeah, like, that's
stronger together.
Like, I just, like, the eating disorder people, like, I haven't spoken to many of them, admittedly, because of COVID. But Colette, and just like, I've read a lot of the pamphlets and like done a lot of research. It's just nice to know that, like, in a backwards way, that it is a thing and that it can be treated. And I think that's what calms me down, knowing that it can be treated. Like, knowing that there's people there, there's care teams to help you, there's, you know, self-help that you can do, there's, you're not in it alone. Like, there's so many charities, like, I'm sure, I don't know if there's many in America, but over here, like, there's a lot of charities and helplines. I've used, like, Samaritans here before. Mm-hmm. Like, I've used loads of different helplines whenever my mental health got bad, and, you know, no one's going to judge you, which I like as well, especially when it comes to the Disorder Association ambassador team. Like, no one's going to judge you because mm-hmm. everyone's been there or understands. They're all trained to understand, which is really nice. And I think they've helped me kind of, like, Colette specifically has just helped me massively with confidence, like, massively. Like, she's been like, you know what, when you die, this is so morbid, but, like, this has really helped me personally. She's like, when you die, there's not going to be people at your funeral talking about your thigh gap. She was like, I'm like, that's so gross to think about, but, like, I was like, you know what, that's so true. And, like, that, like, stupid things like that, like, do help me. Like, that really helps me put things in perspective. You know, like, it just, I don't know, like, if that makes sense.
No, it's, yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's nice to know that it exists. Like, you're not, yes, it's not something yes. that's specifically wrong with you, but that it's something that happens to people, not just you.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's, that's just something that chronically ill people go through. Cause I feel like chronic illness isn't as common as, you know, not being chronically ill. And it's nice to see people that have a similar experience as you, or just go through what you have been
yeah.
through.
Yeah.
And again, it's like that isolation that you get, like, you know, people that don't mm-hmm. live in, like, big cities or big towns, like, here in the U.S., I happen to live in a larger city, so, like, I know a lot of people with type 1, but there are people, like, out in the middle of the country that don't, or, like, yeah. they're the only type 1 within, like, 50 miles.
Yeah.
So it's, like, it's really difficult to feel like you're not the only one. And that can be really, you know, the isolation. It's something that can make it harder for you to take care of yourself, because, like, you don't Definitely. Have anybody to compare yourself to, or you don't know anybody Definitely. That's going through the same thing or meeting up with the same struggles. Like, you know, eating pizza is really hard for me. Like, why don't I know anybody that yeah. understands that? So yeah, it helps feeling or knowing that you're not the only one. And that's, I think that's something that everybody kind of goes through. But, like, for chronically ill people, it's something that is, like, more apparent, I think.
It's, like, really similar, like, I can kind of, it's really similar to, like, you know, your sexuality in a way, yeah. like, it's so mm-hmm. similar. Like, I remember, like, as a kid, like, in the middle of it all, like, I have not really talked about this ever. I'm not hiding it from anybody. It's just because of family and stuff. It's not like my family wouldn't accept me being bi or queer or whatever. It's just, like, easier to just, like, not go into details. Like, I've told them in the past, and they either do not care at all and want me to live my best life, or just don't understand. But, like, when I was like 12 and stuff, I definitely knew I was, like, queer, and not having, like, immediate, like, not having queer, like, queer people around me, and not having diabetics around me as well, like, it was so difficult. It was, like, two things I was dealing with by myself. And then, unfortunately, when I actually met queer people, like, they didn't understand my diabetes, so I had to kind of pick whether I wanted safety within being queer or safety within being diabetic, because there wasn't people with both. I went to university and I met, like, my best friend ever, Anthony, who is a disabled queer, like myself, and we lived our best lives, so once I met him, like, it was great.
Yeah, again, it's just nice knowing that you're not the only one. There's just something about it. It's really hard to kind of put into words, but again, feeling like you're the only person like yourself for years mm-hmm. and years. Like, I was diagnosed when I was 12 too. And yeah. it was hard not, like, knowing that you were different from everybody else, even though you didn't look it. And it was something that people couldn't really assume, because, again, like, we look fine. Yeah. Isolation is a big thing for the chronically ill community. And you said that you found a lot of help from social media. Is that where it started, or did you, like, started meeting people? Like, which one came first, do you think?
Oh, I've always been really into, like, Snapchat, and I really liked the story aspect. And then when Instagram started doing Insta stories, I was on that. Like, I loved it, because I didn't really like Instagram because it was so pick the right photo for the grid sort of thing. So now, then when stories came about, I was on top of that. And I just started posting about my diabetes and quickly found a few people with similar insulin to me, they lived in similar areas to me. So some people were in the UK, and like slowly started finding more and more people. The first diabetic I ever followed was, I have it in my head, T1D chick.
Jillian, yeah,
she was the first. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, she's got the best accent. She's like from New York, I think, yeah. Or like New Jersey or something. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like she's got an Omnipod. Like, what is that? And then, because like we just don't have that. And I remember thinking, oh, she's class. Like she has all her shit together. And like she drinks iced coffee. Like she's living her best life.
She's the main character.
Yeah, she's the main character. Like I loved it. And then I just liked that she also was really realistic. So like she posted her bad days. And it was just really nice to see that like this person had like a job, a life, had type 1 diabetes, and it was under control, but she also was realistic about it, and I loved that. And it wasn't glamorized, which is like the main point as well. Like I hate people glamorizing illnesses. I have such a big problem with that. And she just was so realistic about it and just there to help people, and that's kind of where it grew from. And then I started following artists that were disabled and artists that were also diabetic, and following and doing a lot more with my art, because it was like a big way for me to kind of explore my diabetes more, especially in university, because I had a big problem with like being somebody who was a woman and like having an illness and having all these like attachments. Like I couldn't really come to terms with being like desired, but also like having like stuff attached to me. And like drawing and painting at university really helped me like explore that a lot more, as well as like I suppose my sexuality as well. Like it all kind of just, social media and art, I'd say, were the two main things for me. I never have went to like a meetup before, or I've never done anything like that. Like I don't really know anybody here.
Yeah, meetups are really helpful, but yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with social media. It basically just opens up your ability to find people like yourself, and they're definitely a lot of cons to social media, like you said. Like you can curate, you know, make it seem a lot prettier than it actually is, but at the same time you can also, if you're diligent about it and you're honest with yourself, you can definitely like paint the picture that of your actual life. And it's helpful when people do that, especially people that you can relate to, and like you know, like Jillian and her iced coffee.
Free shout out.
yeah but that, I just thought that was funny. But yeah, and it's just really great understanding that you're not alone in it, and you can find people that have like very similar experiences to yours. Like we're all very individual, and like our experiences are our own, but it's nice to know that you're not alone. And then Ronan, earlier you mentioned mental health, like your own mental health, and then Edie's mental health. Did learning about Edie's type 1 diabulimia, her mental health, you know, struggles, did it put anything into perspective for you living with your own struggles and then having Edie with hers? Like how do those two come together?
It's actually sort of worked out as well as it could have worked out, because we sort of go in this sort of cycle where something will be wrong with me. Like I struggled with my depression, and then I'm okay now at this point, and I have been for a little while. So whenever she discovered the diabulimia, I had just gotten okay.
Yeah.
So that's how it works for us, really.
But you discovered you had depression in the midst of me having my insulin pump, and I was in a good place, Like, once we were uni, if that's what you mean?
Whenever she got her pump, I discovered my depression.
Yeah, really. Quite bad. I think it's put things in perspective, though, because you feel like you're able to understand things.
Yeah, definitely. I can understand it a lot more, because I can understand the living with struggles.
That probably helps with like the whole team aspect of it, and it's like you're in this together. And then through your kind of mental health, like working through that, has Edie, like having her own like health and mental struggles, like helped? Like, have you learned anything from her specifically that has helped you go through your process?
I wouldn't have went to the doctor if I didn't have Edie. Edie's the reason I went to the doctor, because she was educated in it. Because she had struggled with stuff before, so she knew what to do. And But I kind of see her as like an authority on these sort of things. So I was able to sort of be like, yeah, okay, maybe I should go the wrong way because he's saying I'm being a bit off. So I wouldn't have went to the doctor about mm-hmm. it if I didn't have Eddie and if Eddie didn't have her problems. So, yeah.
I think we both kind of saved each other and our own struggles, like really and truly. Because, like, if I didn't have Roman, I don't think I would personally have started taking my care of myself more. Because I knew, like, oh, I'm gonna have a family someday. I see myself wanting to live with this person for like, well, a while. I'll keep it for a while, like. But I just like knew that I wanted to take care of myself for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I slowly learned I also needed to do it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a great way to think to do it for somebody else, but it helped me get to where I am now, personally. Like,
when you're in the midst of something mental health related,
yeah,
you're not really thinking about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know for me, like with my depression, like when I'm in a bad state, I don't give a shit about myself. Like, but the fact that Edie's worried is the thing that gets me to help myself, you know what I mean? So whenever I'm in that state, I just want to just sit there and do nothing.
Yeah,
you have the somebody to keep an eye out for those early warning signs.
Exactly.
Yeah, one of the, like, there's a lot of early warning signs for depression, but one of them is like a lack of interest in personal hygiene. Like, you know, you don't want to like mm-hmm. get ready in the morning. You don't feel like washing, like doing the laundry. Like, you don't do it as much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just very little things. And those are very subtle. Like, you know, who wants to do laundry every week? Like, it's very easy to like just put it off for a couple weeks. But if you're putting it off for like months at a time, there's like something going on.
I think you noticed whenever I didn't do my hair one day.
Yeah, like, I just noticed, like, you wouldn't, because we were at uni, and I love going on nights out, and Ronan only really went on nights out, like, for big occasions.
I'm not a night out person in general.
But, like, well, you were very, like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to do that. And then, because of my diabetes, in uni especially, I got very anxious going places by myself in case I went low, because my lows are very bad. Like, I literally feel like, I know everyone feels them differently. I just get them really, really badly. So whenever I'm with somebody, it comforts me. I know I can't be with somebody all the time, but for places like nights out and going to the shops and gym and stuff, it helped me a lot. So when you lost interest and stuff like that, it made me panic, because I was like, oh, I know he would do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you love going to like shops and stuff. Like, why do you not want to do it anymore? And then, but I think we both, now that we have our things that we deal with individually, whenever something's up, we both encourage each other to go see a doctor first and foremost, because we both know the disadvantages that come with not going, like, long term.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so many. Like, you're just safer going to the doctor at the end of the day. And I know it's, like, in America, it might be slightly different, because I hear about, like, it's like, it can be expensive and stuff. Like, and we're so fortunate that we can just be, like, ring up our GP and say, hi, such and such is happening. Like, we really do have that as a privilege.
Yeah,
there is definitely that added. So there's, like, the stigma of being sick and not wanting to be sick, and mental health especially, like, not wanting to be, like, mentally ill, in quotes. And then on top of that, in the US, it's really just difficult to go to the doctor. Like, it's really expensive, or it's just, like, there's a long wait period. You can't just go. Like, I can't decide today that I want to go to the doctor. Like, you have to, there's, like, a waiting list. And it's, you know, depending on insurance and all that, it can be different. Like, it's not, like, it's not an immediate thing. Yeah, but it's a good point to bring up. Like, there's a lot of, like, roadblocks in getting the help that you need. And then added roadblocks just make that even harder.
Yeah.
But when you have somebody, like, there by your side and with you, and, like, can, like, make note of those things before, earlier, how you said it was a team. Like, you guys keep an eye out for each other. And it's nice to have those early warning signs, like, get noticed by somebody, because, again, like, it's very easy to, like, overlook that, especially, like, from your own perspective. So, like, the show's about the questions that people ask about type 1. Ronan, did you have any questions about diabulimia specifically? Because it sounds like you two discovered it or found out about it at the same time together, basically. So was there anything that you learned about it or wanted to learn about it, like, as Edie was kind of, like, realizing that that's what she went through?
I don't think he did.
I don't think so, because we were both sort of learning it together.
Yeah. We said earlier in the podcast, which is a cool thing to say, we said earlier in the podcast that, that like, you're told by the doctor that you will lose weight if you don't take insulin. So there's nearly like that being told at you at such a vulnerable time. And I think that encourages and diably may when a doctor's telling you all that information at such a vulnerable time, which is like no fault of their own, because they you kind of need to know it. But unfortunately, I think it sends people down the wrong path.
Yeah, like kind of going back to the idea of like your care team, like if they're insensitive or just like not aware of what they're telling people, or like this the mental state of a person when they're telling is like, oh, if you just don't take insulin, you're going to lose weight a lot, or like you're going to lose weight really quickly. For you can tell that to 10 different people and they'll take it differently, but there's that one person, or that, you know, four people in this case, that will take that information and like, you know, put it in the back. It's like, oh, if I just don't take my insulin, I'll lose weight. And it's just like, and I guess it's just a misunderstanding of where like mental health too, like, you know, general practitioners aren't always like, they don't make those connections. That information can be dangerous for somebody to hear at a certain point. So I think it might just take a little bit more education on how to give that information and like who to give it to, or like what, how you explain those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Because if you're a highly anxious person, getting that information can like really send you down a dark path.
Yeah, definitely.
Like eating disorders or diabulimia. So yeah, because, you know, eating disorders at the heart of them are anxiety disorders. And it's just like that's the mind's way of like reconciling it. It's like controlling what you eat. So
Yes.
Again, it's just like a way of, it's something that I don't know, the medical community can look into and figure out like how best to give that information without bringing on more issues than, you know, they would have had otherwise.
I've noticed like a lot of people with diabetes on social media, like no one in particular, just like a few different people, have like a nearly like a control complex over their diabetes. And I think it's like similar to eating disorders, like you need to have that like control over something. And if it doesn't go right, because I know for me, like if I'm trying my best at getting my blood sugars in order and it doesn't go right, I freak out because I've put so much energy into it. And it's like the diabulimia, you have like 100% control over it. And I think it calms you down as a diabetic to know that, yeah, you might not be doing it right, but you're doing something with like a crappy situation. And it's just so dangerous that like your brain flips it on itself. I think what I would tell any new diabetic at all is like, first and foremost, get a mental health team or see somebody for your mental health alongside learning about diabetes. Because I didn't have any help at all. Like I wasn't offered any help for my mental health whenever I got diagnosed, like none until I was about 16. Definitely see a mental health team without a doubt. And if you have social media, which most people do, try your best, use that to your advantage. Even if you don't want to post stuff personally, just like following people that have diabetes, have autoimmune conditions. Like I don't specifically follow diabetics. I follow people with like PCOS, Crohn's disease, you know, loads of different disorders, immune disorders. And it's just seeing how people cope with them, really. Because I think when your mental health is good, your physical health kind of just like does its thing like with it. Like your mental health is so important, because if you're not there mentally, you're not going to do the things that you need to do to get your physical self back to the way it was.
Yeah, definitely. It's all part of the same thing. Your mental health can greatly influence your physical health. And so kind of getting them both on the same page, or like just realizing that, can be really helpful for people so that they can get the help that they need.
Yeah, I did like a video about this on my Instagram. Like, don't be embarrassed. It's like something I always tell people. It's really difficult because I suppose diabetes has a lot of taboos, like injecting, you know, there's loads of problems that can go wrong with symptoms, like for women, like thrush, and I guess thrush for men as well, like sexual dysfunctions, like so many different things can go wrong, quote unquote wrong. But it's knowing that like this is your fault, and like there's always help out there, and like trying not to be embarrassed. And I think that's such an easy thing to say. And like for me, the only thing that helped me was seeing other people thriving with their diabetes, you know, not hiding it, like decorating it instead.
Yeah, that's great. So thank you for sharing your story. Any last words of wisdom before we head out?
Take your meds.
That's good. Yeah.
Drink water.
Take your insulin. Drink water. Yeah.
Don't worry. That's something. Yeah. I just got a new diabetic nurse and a new dietitian, and her name's Sandra, and she's brilliant. She told me, you know, if it doesn't go right one day, you can just wake up tomorrow and try again. And she's diabetic, so it really comforts me to know that she completely understands everything that I go through. Like, there's no perfect way to do something. There's no textbook way to be a diabetic. You know, you find what works for you, and if someone questions it, as long as you're taking care of yourself and you're actively trying to find help, you know, tell that person to
call. Ronan, anything you'd like the people to know before we head out?
Probably just, like, don't be afraid to get your partner involved in your community and stuff, mm-hmm. because, like, it's important for the relationship, I think, mm-hmm. and if you're sort of involved in one thing and your partner isn't, then the relationship might struggle a little bit. And I think it's important to be involved in each other's lives and things that are important to each other. And I think because you were very nervous about apprehensive about telling me all everything, I just think don't be afraid to tell.
I think one thing we both discovered recently that comforts me is to know that at the start of anything, like, it's going to be really, really, really difficult. Like, you need to know that. Mm. Like, no bullshit. It's going to be hard, but over time, it will just become second nature. And trying to focus on that, as hard as it may be, like, you know, my insulin pump, when I first got it, hated it. I was too stressed all the time. But now it's, like, it's basically, like, having, like,
That's great. Yeah, it is. It's important to, I think, realize that your significant others, your, you know, husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever, partners, they can only be there as much, you know, so much. And because, like, if they don't have your same condition, they can't really relate to it 100%, but they can help you and support you. And then they can also encourage you to get that help from somebody else. Like, as long as you have support or you feel supported within your own chronic illness or your own mental health struggles, that's kind of, like, the point of it all. It doesn't necessarily have to come from the same person. It would be nice, but, like, that's not realistic. And it's a lot of pressure to put on your type nuns in this case. And that just doesn't have to be there. Like, they can definitely help you or point you in the right direction, or, like, get you to people that can help you. It doesn't all have to fall on this one person.
Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Like, everyone makes mistakes. I think as long as you're trying your best, there's nothing more you can ask for in the world. Like, it's so important to remember.
Yeah, making mistakes is part of it. Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining me and talking about this. This was really great.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye. Right,
bye. Thank you.
See you later.
And that's the episode. You'd think that with all the things type 1 puts us through, that we'd get some kind of a break somewhere. Like, the constant monitoring of BG levels and insulin dosing and staying on top of what we're eating wasn't enough. Now we have to keep an eye out for things that medical professionals aren't even fully aware of yet. Frustrating is an ironically frustrating understatement. This, of course, makes talking about the experiences like these all the more important because, like Edie said, we never know who else might be going through the same thing. In Edie's case, finally being able to give her eating disorder experience a name and talking about it with her medical team, even after the fact, made a world of difference. Which makes sense. How do you really work through something that you don't know you're going through, let alone one you don't have a name for? So again, if you relate to Edie's story, know someone who might, or if you'd just like to learn more about diabulimia or diabetic mental health in general, take a look at the Diabulimia Helpline. They're a nonprofit dedicated to supporting, educating, and advocating for people with diabetes and mental health issues, especially eating disorders. You'll find the link to their website in the bio and the show notes for this episode. And in other Ask Me About My Type 1 news, this is going to be the last episode of Season 4, lucky number 13. I figured it was the most appropriate number to end this train wreck of a year on. I'd like to give a huge thank you to all of you listening right now who stuck by me and the show to keep this type 1 diabetes conversation going throughout this whole year. I wouldn't have been able to get through it without all of you, so I hope I was able to give you a little bit of entertainment and maybe even teach you something along the way. If you'd like to stay in touch over my winter break, the Ask Me About My Type 1 DMs and email, which you can also find on Instagram, will always be open, so feel free to say hi. I'd also love any and all input you might have for what you want to hear from Ask Me About My Type 1 in Season 5. So, if you have guests you want me to have on, topics you want to discuss, or hey, more pharma-funded orgs that need calling out, please let me know, because I'm here for it. Thanks again so much for tuning in, and I'll see you again in 2021. Bye.